It's time for Hoag Health Radio. Here's your host, Deborah Howell.
Hello, Cleveland. Just kidding. Cheers, and welcome back to the show. So glad you could spare a few minutes to spend with us. On the show today, I have the extreme pleasure of having Dr. Philip Robinson with me. He's the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at Hoag Memorial. Welcome to you, Dr. Robinson.
Hello there.
We are once again getting right down to it. Some people listening right now to this show are afraid to eat pork, thinking they might contract the H1N1 flu by ingesting the meat. What would you say to that, doctor?
Well, I'm kind of not surprised with the association because initially in this pandemic, we called the virus swine flu, which is now politically incorrect.
Okay.
I want to reassure your audience that there is absolutely no way that one could get the swine flu by eating pork products. The reason why the virus initially was named after swine was because when you look at the genetic material within the virus, pieces of it did come from other influenza viruses that like to infect pigs.
Okay.
But there are also pieces of viruses, influenza viruses, that infect waterfowl and humans. So this particular H1N1, it's not fair to call it the swine flu because it's got pieces of bird flu and pieces of human flu in it all at the same time. But there is no way to get it from eating pork products.
Thanks so much for arresting those fears. Now, where does the swine flu, and where does it come from if it doesn't come from the areas you just mentioned?
Well, what happens is that influenza can infect different organisms. It can obviously infect humans, and it can infect swine, and it can infect birds, in particular waterfowl. And what happens is, in areas of the world where humans, pig, and waterfowl live closely together, any one of these organisms can get infected with more than one virus at the same time.
I see.
And the virus, in the process of reproducing itself, it can kind of get scrambled up if there are several different types of viruses in the same organism. And when it emerges from that particular host or organism, it might look a little different than it did when it started, because it's got little pieces of all the different types of viruses. And then that might spread from person to person.
Okay, and how does one contract H1N1?
Well, typically we'll breathe it in. If somebody coughs, that sputum that gets expelled, the little droplets, will contain pieces of live virus.
Okay.
If that virus then gets into your body, and it typically has to enter through a mucous membrane, your mouth, your nose, and most importantly your eyes, the virus can then get in and start causing an infection in you.
That's interesting, because usually people think to protect themselves. For instance, Mark in Culver City just sent us an email. He wanted to know if you need to wear a mask while flying on a plane on a long flight, but you never think of really protecting your eyes.
Right. And studies that have looked at this, the eyes seem to be the biggest door into your body. Again, the mouth has quite a bit of immune system just kind of sitting there waiting to attack any invaders. But wearing the mask is an area of a bit of controversy. You know, in the hospital, in order to protect our patients and our healthcare workers, we have everybody wear masks that have infections like influenza in order to interrupt transmission. But out in the general public, they're really discouraged, and they're discouraged for several reasons. Number one, most people don't really know how to wear masks.
Okay.
You know, in the hospital, we put a mask on before going in to see a patient, and then we take it off and dispose of it. So the mask may only be on us for a few minutes.
Right.
And then we go to see another patient, and we put a new, fresh mask on. Typically, when people wear masks in the community, they may keep them on all day. And if they gather moisture or dirt, they become very ineffective. Plus, they can also act as an actual mechanism to transmit the flu. If you've got virus on the outside of the mask, maybe you were wearing a mask and someone coughed on you and the virus stopped it. But that virus is on the outside of that mask.
Okay.
Then you take the mask off. You don't know how really to take it off and not contaminate your hands. And then you scratch your eye. You rub your eyes.
Yep.
And then, boom, you've got it. And the mask actually contributed to you getting an infection. There's one time that I do consider having people wear masks who are not in the hospital. and that is if you yourself are at high risk for the complications of influenza and you cannot avoid an exposure. Maybe you're a mom who might be getting chemotherapy or have something wrong with your immune system, and you have nobody else to help you take care of your son who came home from school today with the swine flu.
Right.
And you're the only caregiver. Under those circumstances, sure, you could consider wearing a mask, but almost as importantly, and maybe more importantly, make sure that you wash your hands well and don't touch your face.
And get instructions from your personal doctor on how to put on a mask and remove it, and also information about how often you can wear it and when you need to dispose of them, all these good things.
Exactly. And there's a lot of information on the website, in particular CDC.gov, about all these issues, the pros and cons of mask wearing and hand hygiene and all of those things.
Now, is it CDC.gov or CDC.org?
It is CDC.gov.
Okay, CDC.gov. I apologize if I gave .org earlier. Let's get into now, say the worst has happened or your worst fears have been confirmed and you or someone in your family has contracted H1N1. Let's talk a little bit about the treatment.
So most people do not require treatment. Most people are going to experience this infection and not be very sick at all. However, in patients that get this and are at risk for the complications of influenza, they should probably initiate treatment or at least discuss the treatment options with their provider. Treatment comes really in two forms. There is a pill that you can take, and then there is also a medicine that you can inhale. Both of them are reasonably effective, but it's important for the audience to know that these antiviral medicines are not the same as giving, let's say, penicillin for strep throat.
Okay.
They're not really curative, but what they can do is reduce the severity of the symptoms and the length that you have the symptoms.
Okay.
And on average, it reduces your illness by maybe a couple days if the medicines are started early. In general, the medicines need to be started within the first 48 hours for them to be effective.
This brings up another great question. When do you go to the doctor? When you have that little tiny tickle in the back of your throat, or do you wait until you have a fever? Or
boy, that's it's a tough question. And
yeah.
It's a tough question because I don't want to overgeneralize. But you know, what I tell my patients is if you think you just have a cold or the flu, just, you know, take care of yourself, or maybe give your doctor a call and let them know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'd like to avoid is a lot of people rushing to their doctors, or worse yet, rushing to the emergency room that have influenza that really wouldn't qualify for treatment, wouldn't qualify for testing, wouldn't qualify for being admitted to the hospital, yet going through that hassle of going into a busy emergency room, for example, and potentially exposing a number of other people unnecessarily. So there are some websites out there, and the CDC.gov has some links to them, sort of almost self-assessment programs that you can go to the website, you can put in your symptoms, and it will give you some advice about whether or not your symptoms would warrant immediate medical attention, just a phone call to the doctor, or maybe, you know, drink lots of fluids, take some Tylenol, and call me in the morning.
Right, and then if your condition worsens seriously and, you know, suddenly becomes more lung and, you know, involved, then you really need to talk to
you. Know, the big danger signs for an adult would be shortness of breath, changes in mental status, maybe confusion, inability to maintain your own nutrition. Maybe there's so much nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea that you just can't keep enough fluid in your body.
Sure.
Those are warning signs for the adult population. In the kids, irritability, rapid breathing, changes in skin color, these things should prompt medical attention.
I hadn't heard about changes in skin color. Could you give us an example?
Sure. You know, if your child is lethargic, they're not really responding all that well, their respiratory rate, their breathing rate may be high, and sometimes under those circumstances the tips of your fingers or toes might turn a little dusky or blue, and that's one of the indications that they may have a pneumonia or other respiratory problems. Very serious sign.
And again, really important, if your child is ill, do not send them off to school.
Absolutely. We want to try to keep the schools open. If we see quite a bit of spread within the schools, that may be something that we may not be able to do. So keeping the child home from school, taking care for them at home, and maybe having a conversation with your doctor is the best thing.
Thank you, Dr. Philip Robinson. You've been so gracious with your time today.
Oh, you're welcome.
And for more information on Dr. Robinson and Hoag Hospital and some great health tips, please visit hoaghospital.org. Once again, cdc.gov has all kinds of great tips for you to keep yourself and your family healthy. This is Deborah Howell for Hoag Health Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Have yourself a great and healthy day.